Hello and welcome to the Local Economic Development Podcast.
Hosted by Sean Cunningham
and Jörg Meyer-Starmer.
For other programs in this series, please take a look at www.ledcast.net.
In today's episode, we will look at one of my favorite topics, and that is the topic of market failure. Jörg, what do we mean with market failure?
Don't we usually explain that market failure is the opposite of marketing failure?
That's something that my professor still can't understand. So marketing failure is when a firm's got a product that they can't necessarily get to a market because they either don't know who would need their product, or they simply don't know how to determine the price, or maybe actually customers simply just don't like what they're trying to sell. Like that one little cartoon with a broccoli milk tart or something like that. So that is not a market failure, that's a marketing failure.
Right, it was broccoli and liver, and obviously nobody would voluntarily want to buy something like that. So if you try to set up your catering business specializing in broccoli and liver, you're quite unlikely to find a large customer base. And that has absolutely nothing to do with market failure, but is purely a marketing failure.
So Jörg, maybe just before we dive into market failure, let's just get this straight. We're not going to scare people now with very theoretical concepts that nobody will understand.
Indeed. The reason why we introduced the subject is that we basically have discovered that it is a quite useful concept, and it is a concept that is very relevant to LED practitioners. And one of the things that we want to point out in this episode is that quite often LED practitioners have a tendency to go for other solutions rather than market solutions, which is often not a good idea. So understanding market failure, being able to identify, to analyze market failure, but also being able to come up with ways to remedy market failure is, in my view, one of the core competencies that any LED practitioner should have.
So what we'll do today is to also look at some of these very easily to recognize symptoms and just discuss them so that people can also see how you would know when you're actually dealing with a market failure and when you're dealing with some other kind of failure. Because Jörg, now, what are the main kinds of market failure that one typically hear of?
Well, when I looked at the literature, what I found is that authors will typically introduce five different types of market failure. And these five types are called natural monopoly, public goods, external effects, and something, my favorite word, indivisibility, and asymmetric information.
So why don't we start with natural monopoly?
Well, natural monopoly was something that happened quite a lot in the past, and that is to some extent going away. So for a long time, we were used to the fact that there was only one telephone company. And that had a lot to do with telephone technology. It was extremely costly to set up a telephone system, so setting up parallel telephone systems didn't make sense. Now, that has changed with the advent of new technologies, with the advent of cell phone technology. But there are still areas where it would be rather silly to try to set up competing providers and competing structures. Imagine, for instance, water provision or sewage, setting up competing companies that dig up competing holes to run competing sewage systems would be utterly silly and very, very inefficient. So that is a typical area of natural monopoly. And that is then something where you will battle to find a market-based solution and where you need to do something else.
Okay, so let's maybe look at the next one, and that would be public goods. Now, we must also say that public goods is an interesting market failure because what is described as a public good market failure in one country is not necessarily the same in another. And an example of a public good would be the provision of, say, education services or of health, basic health services. What you, for example, in Germany would describe as a public good in terms of education, in parts of Africa would still be described as a private good. So with public goods, it's the kind of goods that get provided either by government but also by the private sector, and it's typically to the benefit of the society, of the public. Can you maybe explain and give us a nice example of that?
Well, a public good is typically something that is important and useful to people, but it's really difficult to charge for that. Mm-hmm. So one typical example that is always mentioned is national defense. So it would be kind of tricky. I mean, we tried that in Europe in the Middle Ages, and it really didn't work very well, having national defense on a competitive basis with competing warlords. That is not a nice solution. So that is a typical public good where you want government to actually come in. Another example that I think many of our listeners will be aware of is agricultural extension. So having agricultural advisory services and things like that. That is typically a public good, especially when it's catering for smaller farmers and relatively poor farmers, for the simple reason that it is unlikely that these farmers will be able to pay for commercial provision of agricultural extension and agricultural training.
I think very often different kinds of information that should be available out there, let's say about things like standards or export activities or something like that, is nowadays also considered to be public goods.
And again, it's something where this is considered a public good because it's just difficult to turn that into a profitable business.
Jörg, now a very difficult one to explain to people is external effects, or sometimes referred to as externalities. Can you maybe just quickly go over that one?
Well, you typically come across that in two different ways. One of them is as a so-called positive external effect, and the other one is a negative external effect. The negative external effect is when you, say, have a relatively dirty factory operation running somewhere in your neighborhood and then blasting all the soot all over the neighborhood and everybody's suffering from that. So it is a negative externality because the company could, of course, in principle, set up a filter or change its process, but it would have to spend money on that, whereas by just blasting out the dirt, They are handing out the cost of dealing with this to everybody else in terms of health cost and cleaning cost and so on. A typical example of a positive external effect is, say, skills development. We often come across this situation in a given locality when we do an LED diagnosis that all the companies complain about skills shortages. And then you ask them, well, so why don't you then train your workers? And they say, but then my competitor would poach them. Now, this is exactly a positive external effect. When people are trained by one company and that company pays for that, and these employees then change to another company, that would be a typical example for a positive external effect. And it also tells you why this is a market failure. In an ideal world, all the companies would invest just the right amount of money to build the skills of their employees. But in the real world, they don't do that because they think, well, if I train these guys too much, then they become more attractive, they will change jobs, and my local competitor will benefit from my investment in skills development. So as a consequence, companies underinvest in skills development. So there is this...
Indivisibility. Was that right? It came out right. Okay. So indivisibility occurs when there's the cost of an investment of, say, something like a steel plant. There's just a certain minimum investment that is required to start a steel plant or an airline or something like that. And when that cost is beyond the cost of the average investor or the average business person, that creates a kind of a market failure. And maybe in an LED context, the example of that would be something like a container for export of produce, where a small farmer maybe can fill half a container with tea, but the smallest container that's available is exactly twice their output, and they simply can't afford it. So that actually keeps them from entering into the market.
I think it's something that we've seen very often in local economies. You set up a nice group of producers doing some craft stuff. You take their product to a potential buyer in a foreign market, and the buyer says, oh yeah, fantastic, great product. Can I have 10,000 of that by next week? And the producers then say, how are we going to do that? And they can't do it because that is just beyond their capacity. So that would be another typical example of indivisibility.
I think also that the indivisibility could be a barrier to entry for people to just enter into a sector. Like to start a small furniture factory, if you're a really experienced carpenter, just the startup cost in terms of the equipment that you need to buy, the negative cash flow that you will have until you get your first order in, that can actually just prevent people from entering the market in the first place.
Yep.
And maybe at this point to also say that it's really important in these kind of markets that more people enter, because that is where competition comes from, which in the end benefits the consumer in terms of lower price and higher efficiency.
Maybe let's move to the last of the five types, asymmetric information. So do you have a nice example of asymmetric information?
Better than the original one around lemons and secondhand cars?
I think that's a good one.
Okay, so in the 60s, I think it was Akerlof who wrote a paper on the market for lemons. And in his example, he did not actually refer to a lemon as in a fruit that you drink in your gin and tonic, but he was referring to a second-hand car. And the whole thing with asymmetric information is where one party in a transaction has certain information that the other party doesn't have. So, I mean, it's very simple. I've had to get rid of a second-hand car recently. And it's so difficult to sell it because the buyer doesn't actually know whether I'm selling this car because I'm desperate to get cash or because I know that the engine is going to fall out at some other point. So in that kind of thing, in that kind of situation, transactions don't occur because people don't have the right information, or one party's got more information than the other party, and there's a sort of a suspicion involved.
Another example that I personally came across at one point was when I was buying seeds for rocket salad. So that is one of the very fashionable salad varieties these days. And when you go into a shop, they would typically offer you two different types of seeds. One of them is the natural variety, one of them is a refined variety. Both look exactly the same, and one of them, the refined variety, is 10 times more expensive than the natural variety. And the difference is mostly that the refined variety has a slightly more amenable taste. It's a slightly nicer taste. It's not quite as rough as the traditional, the conventional rocket salad. But you can't figure that out by just looking at the seeds. So when you see them next to each other, they just look exactly the same. So you really have to trust your seller that this one variety is the proper refined variety, which is more valuable. And if you don't trust the seller, then you're probably just not going to spend that money for something which would in fact be a superior product.
Now, while large firms very often also suffer from this kind of market failure, small firms are a bit more prone to this, especially the really small informal contractors or smaller farmers who, when they go to a supplier and say, I want this product, and they get it in a bag without labeling on, they would have to trust the supplier completely that this is actually the product that they want, adhering to the specs that they want. And it's also very relevant to small farmers who enter into new products like organic fertilizers and that, where there's absolutely no way that you can test whether this fertilizer is truly organic or not. And, so it could actually break down, prevent certain kinds of transactions from taking place completely.
And the reason why it is particularly relevant for smaller businesses, obviously, is that a big company will typically have its own lab, or can easily contract a lab to conduct such tests, whereas for a small business, they won't have their own lab, and it may just be far too costly, or they may not have a lab easily available within their reach where they could do this kind of testing.
So, there's markets, and there's hierarchies, and there's networks, and there's market failure. How do these things relate to each other, and why should we be discussing this in the first place? Our listeners are probably thinking, here comes an economics lesson right now.
Which indeed is exactly what is happening just now, but let's try to make this still comprehensible. When you look at the way things happen in the real world, there is really only three ways in which within an economy coordination can take place. The one thing is the market, and the advantage of the market is that it works out because people are pursuing their self-interest. So there isn't anybody who has to switch on the market in the morning. There isn't anybody who has to sit there all the time and make sure that the market participants behave properly. So a market, a real market, if you think of a weekly market or your standard market in any commodity, that works pretty well because of the self-interest of the market participants, the sellers and the buyers. And that is the nice thing about markets. For me personally, I must say, this whole issue about liking markets has nothing to do with ideology, as opposed to other people who have an ideological preference for markets. For me, it's purely a matter of practicality. I've seen other types of coordination work not so well and involving a lot of suffering. And from that angle, I like markets when they work properly, which obviously requires a couple of things, such as governments making sure that monopolies do not emerge. However, coming back to the initial point, the three types. So, in fact, basically there's three ways of organizing things. The market is one of them. The second one is what economists call hierarchy. And that is an organization where somebody is giving orders and a couple of other people are obeying those orders, hopefully. So government is a typical example of a hierarchy, but also any company is an example of a hierarchy. So in a hierarchy, people do things because they are told to do so. And there's always the problem for those who are giving the orders to make sure that those who are supposed to follow those orders actually do that. The third type of coordination is that where people get together voluntarily to do something, to address something. And that is called network. So there's formalized networks. Business association is a typical network, but also any kind of club is one type, is a type of network. And then there's also obviously informal networks, like companies working together informally or professionals working together informally, meeting occasionally to exchange experience and stuff like that. So this is yet another type of coordinating things, which is typically based on meetings and workshops, and thus is rather time-consuming. It has the advantage of addressing, being able to address issues that otherwise are difficult to address, and has a disadvantage of being rather time-consuming.
It's maybe important to point out that with hierarchies, it isn't just the fact that there's orders being sent down the organization, the physical framework of the organization, the rules of that organization, it's all part of the hierarchy. Somebody somewhere said this is the way things are done here, and there is an element of control. Even if it is a company like Google, where it seems like there are very few rules, there's a very specific hierarchy at play in a company like Google. And then maybe also to say that with networks, it's important to distinguish between this formal and informal, because development practitioners are often exposed to these very formal networks that are established by donors or organizations, and they very often ignore these informal networks that could exist around a golf club or even other social structures like a church or a school or even just a friendship circle. So there's many cultures where these informal networks over time become very powerful, even the formal ones. We've only spoken about market failure this far. So I would then assume that there's a hierarchy failure and a network failure. What are the conditions for these things to occur?
Well, what typically happens within hierarchies is that the guys who are giving the orders at some stage notice that their staff are not following those orders. And then ultimately organizations just tend to break down and tend to become ineffective, where everybody inside the organization pursues their own particular interests without keeping the organization's overarching goal in mind. So that would be a typical example of organizational failure. And I think we've seen a lot of that, in particular with respect to government failure in many of the countries where we are working, where government organizations simply don't work. For instance, because the staff is rotating all the time and nobody knows who's actually in charge, or people at lower levels simply don't have the skills to execute the orders that they are given, or for all sorts of other reasons.
You know, and if you think about that just for a second, then governments and companies, hierarchies in essence, there's a lot of reasons why they often fail for very similar reasons, both in firms and in government departments. Power and decision-making is typically very often centralized to the top. But Jörg, the question is, if a lot of people like markets because they are so efficient, and a lot of people don't like hierarchies because they're saying they're so cumbersome. And the internet age, some people announce this is the end of the firm. Just why do these things exist still today?
The simple fact is that each of them has certain advantages and certain disadvantages. And as a matter of fact, they also rely on each other. It's really tricky to imagine a society that is purely organized around markets. I wouldn't want to imagine that. We've seen societies that were predominantly and almost exclusively organized around hierarchy, like in the former Soviet Union, and that also didn't work very well. And imagining a society that exclusively relies on networks, well, just imagine the time you would spend in meetings there. That would be rather irritating. So each of those organizations has specific advantages and specific disadvantages. Markets have the advantage that they work all by themselves, and the disadvantage that if they are left to their own devices, they tend not to work after some time because somebody emerges as the monopolist. That is what typically happens in markets over time. So there needs to be somebody who makes sure that markets work, and that is typically government. So there needs to be hierarchy to come in to make markets work. Now, hierarchies occasionally collapse for the reasons that we have just pointed out. And what we see in the real world, then, is that when governments, for instance, become dysfunctional, there's typically markets or networks coming in to solve the problem. So the example you gave earlier, we have many countries where government is not particularly effective in health provision, where government is not particularly effective in skills provision, and where then because people are obviously desperate for health services and are really keen on skills development, private providers pop up. Or alternatively, networks form, like in a neighborhood, people get together to address specific health issues. So there, then when hierarchy fails, either markets or networks come in to address this failure. And otherwise, obviously, networks are a very important element in making markets work, because for businesses, for instance, it's absolutely crucial to be involved in business networks. But networks are also very important for government. I mean, we've often argued that within local economic development, a government that is acting purely on its own, without being involved in networks with all sorts of other players, communicating formally and informally, is not going to be a very effective provider of local economic development.
So we also have to realize that there are costs and benefits to each of those three that I think you've basically just outlined. Now, Jörg, whenever we go to places where LED processes are going on, we often see that LED practitioners and donors and development agencies very often prefer certain solutions or certain organizations over others. So we've seen that LED practitioners very often like hierarchies. They actually like to set up agencies or special vehicles or something like that. And we've also seen that at a local level, people like the network thing and they become obsessed with that there must be a network and it must be formal and, you know, it's development by committee or development by meeting. Why is this, and what should we do about this?
My personal theory is that everybody has a natural preference and an intuitive preference for one of those three modes. People who have a business background typically think that markets are the best thing to work, and they tend to try to organize just everything as a market, which is not a good idea. People who have a government background or a large organization background typically think that large organizations are the way to do things, and they just try to squeeze everything into organizations, which is also not a good idea. And people who have a background as networkers, I mean, there are these individuals who are just natural networkers, who just love to communicate with everybody, who are involved in so many formal and informal organizations, they just think that that is the right way to do things. And that is why they suggest this as the predominant solution, the preferred solution. I think the main message that we want to get across is that in any given situation, you want to take an informed decision. So if you're doing local economic development, don't opt for either market or hierarchy organization or network because you think that it's per se the best solution. In any case, in any situation, think this through and ask yourself, so if we want to address this problem, what would a market-based solution look like? What would a hierarchy-based solution look like? What would a network-based solution look like? What are the advantages and the disadvantages of each of those solutions? And what is the solution that is probably going to work best and that is going to be most efficient?
I think that's very practical. Something that I must just say about what we typically find in local economies, two market failures that so often feature. The one is around information or the lack thereof or the total fragmentation in terms of information. And one must again there be very careful that it's not about necessarily increasing the amount of available information to a certain threshold, because a lot of stakeholders are then just again simply overwhelmed by the information and they can't make a choice. So you don't always solve the market failure by trying to increase what it is short of.
Indeed, and I think the critical point really is to understand what is the underlying reason for a given problem. And rather than intuitively assuming that when a market doesn't work, government is necessarily the solution or network is necessarily the solution, one will often be better advised to check, now, why exactly is it that the market doesn't work? And what can we do to make the market work? One of the examples that I often like to use is the example of product certification, product testing and certification, which is a very important issue these days, not only in agricultural products. And we've often seen situations where, especially in developing countries, testing facilities and certification facilities simply didn't exist. And then government came in and set up a government-owned operation, which obviously had then an interest not to let any competitor, especially not any private competitor, in, so that ultimately the services maybe were offered on a sustained basis, but were also offered at a relatively high price, whereas in other locations and other places, for instance, private organizations, private companies got together, pulled in competing private providers for testing and for certification, and ultimately got a much better cost, a much better price for this kind of service. So in a given situation, we often see that local stakeholders tend to come in with a solution that is ultimately hindering the market, the emergence of markets, and create an organization that then needs constant oversight and that needs constant interference to make sure that they are constantly upgrading their services and providing their services at a good level of quality. And that is ultimately for me the reason why I am often fond of market-based solutions, because in that case you don't have to pay so much attention. What we typically find, I think, in local economies is that when a couple of business people look at a given problem and come up with competing solutions, competing services to address this issue, then that is a way that the issue is addressed in a sustained manner and in a manner that over time increases efficiency and makes the service even better for local businesses and for local stakeholders.
So what you're basically saying is that in markets, competition is good because it forces the firms to become more effective and efficient in what they're doing, to be more productive, to use better technology. And consumers benefit because they can actually get access to better prices or better service. So whenever we get into a market and there's very little competition, we start thinking, what could be behind this? We start looking at those symptoms.
I think we should leave it at that for now. Maybe we should give references to some further literature, some further reading that people can look up.
Jörg, have you not written something on this topic recently?
It's actually available on the MESO Partner website. So it's www.mesopartner.com. Just look under publications, scroll down a bit, and there you find an article that looks specifically at making markets work.
And we will be releasing another publication on market failure soon?
Hopefully, yes.